Introducing WonderSuite from Bluehost.com, the tool that makes WordPress wonderful for everyone. Website creation is hard, but now with Bluehost, you can answer a few simple questions about your business and goals, and the WonderSuite tools will automatically lay out your WordPress website or store in minutes. Seriously. From there, you can customize your design, pick your brand colors, and add blocks. No custom theme or coding required. You'll get content suggestions that you can keep or revise. And with Yoast SEO built in, we automatically help you get found in search engines. From step-by-step guidance to suggested plugins to an AI-powered help bot, our built-in tools make WordPress wonderful for everyone. Whether you're a beginner or a pro, you can join over 2 million Bluehost users. Go to bluehost.com/wondersuite. That's bluehost.com/wondersuite. Introducing WonderSuite from bluehost.com, the tool that makes WordPress wonderful for everyone. Website creation is hard, but now with Bluehost, you can answer a few simple questions about your business and goals, and the WonderSuite tools will automatically lay out your WordPress website or store in minutes. Seriously. From there, you can customize your design, pick your brand colors, and add blocks. No custom theme or coding required. You'll get content suggestions that you can keep or revise. And with Yoast SEO built in, we automatically help you get found in search engines. From step-by-step guidance to suggested plugins to an AI-powered help bot, our built-in tools make WordPress wonderful for everyone. Whether you're a beginner or a pro, you can join over 2 million Bluehost users. Go to bluehost.com/wondersuite. That's bluehost.com/wondersuite.
This episode is powered by zenmeditation.com. The meditation is the primary focus. The bigger goal is for people to understand and love themselves, thus creating more harmony in the community at large. To find out more about Zen Meditation's teacher training programs, retreats, and all things Zen Meditation, go to denmeditation.com.
Welcome to Den Talks Podcast. This is Tal, your host and the founder of Den Meditation. We have an amazing guy on today. His name is Jonathan Hammond. He is a shaman, energy worker, spiritual teacher. He's really quite incredible. He speaks very practically, which you guys know I love. There's some themes that we've talked about on here before, but he gives you like takeaways that's going to kind of make you sit and go, huh, and really practical ways to look at your life and start peeling the layers. So you don't want to miss this episode because I feel like just a couple things he said, I know right away, I was like, I need to do that every single moment and every single day. And that's going to really help me grow in areas that I've been feeling stuck. He lives in Maui now, but he used to be in Manhattan. He was actually a successful actor on Broadway and had kind of a major epiphany that he really needs to step into his shamanic work, which he'd been doing on the side. And since then, it's just been taking off. He has clients all around the world for his energy work. He teaches all around the world. He teaches at Omega, everywhere you could possibly imagine. He is so incredible. And again, just this grounded, down-to-earth guy who says it like it is. But he really does come from this point of view of remembering that everything is of nature and everything is of this world. But don't forget, he was in New York, so he doesn't do it in this woo-woo way. It's in of this, remember how nature works, remember how it interacts, remember what is happening out there, and how are you mimicking that in your day-to-day life? Or are you taking a hierarchical approach and looking at it as if you were better or above, and that's what you need to dismantle. So I really appreciate his point of view. I really appreciate the ease of conversation. And again, the ease of ways you can implement some stuff in your life just by the way you start shifting your perspective. I hope you feel the same way. Enjoy the episode. Drop a line. Oh, also, he has a great book out called The Shaman's Mind, which you can get anywhere, by Jonathan Hammond. And I suggest you check it out. So talk about, I think what's totally intriguing to me about you is you went to Harvard. You have like a lot of education behind you. You went to Michigan as well, right? Yeah. So talk about how someone, and what did you study at Harvard? What was your major?
I was in music school and then drama school. And then had a whole I won't say a false life, but not my, you know, but 20, 25 years in New York City, in show business. And I thought that I was being spiritual just to traverse the difficulties of show business because I just needed something to hold on to. But the spiritual just kept becoming more and more prevalent in my life. And when around the time that I retired from that, I remember saying to my actor friends, when we were employed, when we were in a show or something, can you not wait for this to be over? I can't wait for this to be over. And they all said, no, I really like this. I don't want it to be over. And I just couldn't wait for it to be over because I wanted to go, because it was all consuming. I wanted to go be spiritual again. And so it was, and then I had always been doing spiritual healing on the side and always made money at it. And always had a, but didn't take it seriously. But it kept taking up a bigger portion of my life. And then there was just this moment where I called up my agent and I said, I don't think I want you to send me out anymore. And he said, I think that's a good idea. I think you need to go. And within a couple of years, I was teaching at the Omega Institute and a whole bunch of other crazy things. So, So,
but that's so, first of all, I love that you went to Harvard for was it drama school? Is that what you said too? Did your parents love that? They're like, you're at Harvard and this is what you're studying.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was, you know, if you think of, I was an actor, you know, they saw this mimic, they saw this person who could become other people. Even if you think of, you know, reading a script and saying what kind of person would say that. So when I'm working with people, it's what kind of person would say it. It's the same skill, you know. If you think of acting, it's you learn the lines, you learn the block, and you hope for inspiration to come through. And it's really not that much different than what I do now. It's just it's kind of a different form of channeling, you know. And there's an art to it. There's an artistry to it, you know. It's not putting something on. It's letting it come through.
Wait, no, that's interesting how it's like you chant. That's interesting how the difference probably, correct me if I'm wrong, is like, so you were saying when you were acting, you used to kind of look on the page, see what it is, see what need to come through, and then allow it to come through to be that thing. And now it's almost like you channel first, probably.
It's a highly empathic process to be, to see, read someone's words and get into them enough that you become them, you know? And that's what I'm doing in healing work. That's really the same process, yeah.
So what show were you on when you were like, I wish this were over? Like, what was the last one?
I was playing Harry Houdini in Ragtime on Broadway. And my entrance was, I was hanging upside down. My first entrance was coming up from the proscenium arch, which is about four stories up. And I came in from the top upside down in a straitjacket with head first and did a whole speech upside down. And I had this moment, opening night of Broadway, thinking, I hate this. This is the pinnacle of my life and I'm so unhappy. I actually don't feel safe, even though all the safety was all taken care of. I feel like the hanged man in the tarot. I feel like I'm upside down. And it was in that, you know, if you look at the hanged man in the tarot, he is upside down, but he's got a halo of enlightenment, you know, not that I'm enlightened, but he's, you know, it's in the upside down that you see, then it's a couple of years after that, but it was in that moment of this is supposed to be the most exciting pinnacle of my life, and I'm not in the right life. And and what was weird about opening night too was that on my leaving my fifth floor walk up apartment in New York to go to the theater, which was just a couple blocks away because I lived in that theater district, as I was closing the door, this happened on opening night on Broadway, there was a praying mantis on my doorknob of my fifth floor walk up.
And so how did I get there?
On my doorknob in New York City. I knew not to kill it, you know, even though I knew not to do that, but it was such a weird sign. And then very recently afterward, I read that Joseph Campbell on his windowsill in New York City also saw a praying mantis, and that really began his work in myth and moving from academia to something more spiritual. So it was very weird that I had the same sign, and I didn't even know exactly what that sign was. So opening night on Broadway that was a very, very odd time for me.
So I would assume so, because you're like, this, here I am, this is an amazing moment, and you weren't enjoying it. How long did it run for?
about a year later, I was done. And during my acting time, you know, I'd done the 6 weeks of ayahuasca in Brazil and all the classes. I'd gone through an interspiritual seminary 2-year program. I'd gone through. I was doing energy healing on the side. Then there was a certain point where, right around this time, where we were never getting up off the couch. I wasn't actually doing energy healing. I was just talking, and I was finding that that there was a transmission that the healing was happening. So then I went back and did counseling training. So I was really in the process of becoming a spiritual practitioner and a shamanic practitioner for a long time, even when I was in that false light. It was just in the closet. It was just sort of in the closet because everyone wouldn't have understood it. But then when I sort of came out and as that, life just made sense. And I experienced, and still do, almost exclusively yeses. It was like once I found the right life, it was like the world was absolutely meeting me. And I think that that's like such an important idea that like when we met, you know, when we think of spiritual, we think of, kind of two branches of spiritual. One is manifestation and making things happen and creating things with your thoughts and positive thinking and working with energy. And the other one is self. And what we have to recognize is what self are we manifesting on behalf of? And when we find the self that we're supposed to be manifesting on behalf of, that's the magic. That's the formula for magic. And so the self wasn't right. And so I could only, but when I got the self right and realized that this wasn't actor, this was healer, you know, and I never went into acting for fame. That was never, it was always the artistry. That's what I was drawn to, but it just wasn't right. And it didn't have the reach, even though you think he's public, he's on Broadway, it didn't have the reach that I'm having now as a professionally spiritual person, you know? And so, that was really important too, but my life became, and still is, just a lot of yeses, a lot of like, a lot of open doors, a lot of like, and when people do say no to me, it's always like, thank you. You know, I wonder why that, it's just, thank you. It's the wrong direction. You know? So I very much live like that.
So talk about actually how, because that is an amazing idea. And I feel like I talk about it too. You know, when you're kind of on the right path, when just things open up and it just feels easier. But you're saying I was kind of in the wrong self. Talk about how how you can find the right self. Because, you know, some people are like, well, does everyone have to be a healer for it to be the right self? And it's like, no, not at all. So talk about finding the right self.
It comes from nature. It comes from nature. It comes from ecology. It comes from our attunement with nature. Everything in nature is spontaneously and unapologetically exactly what it is. And it only wants to be that and only knows how to be that. And in being that, it is connected to the entire rest of nature, of which we are a part, but the rest of nature. And it has a part to play, interconnected and interdependent with everything else by virtue of it being itself. Finding that authentic self, we have to get the culture, the family culture, the political culture, the sociological culture, the philosophical culture, the background about how we in the West think, and how we think of ourselves, what men are, what women are, what we're supposed to be, what's acceptable, what's not acceptable. All that is a mental overlay that obscures the authentic self that emerges. And the easiest way to find it is just to think, this feels right, it doesn't feel right. If I just keep finding, this feels right, this animates me, this is the right direction, this, I can feel it. It's a felt sense, in the same way that everything in nature, I think, is instinctually following their felt sense towards life. But we've even been acculturated out of feeling our feelings and feeling our felt sense toward what is right for us, because what is right for us may bump up against family expectations and sociological expectations, fears about money. I mean, all that stuff, you know? So that was, it was always my attunement with nature and the earth-based spiritual traditions that helped me understand what authentic actually is. And we're not only like nature, we are nature. You know, Native Americans have this idea of the original instructions, meaning that, you know, the turtle, when it's born without a mother, without instruction, knows to go to the water, and it knows how to live, and it knows how to, and it can swim as far, I'm thinking of turtles in Costa Rica, can swim as far away as India, and then make it way back to its original beach where it was born to give birth again. Those are original instructions. That is instinctual nature. And I think that we're more like that, but we are acculturated out of it.
So it's like we come in with original instructions and then we get totally distracted.
Yeah. I think that's what, you know, the shit show that is the world right now, you know, that is just that we are so fundamentally disconnected from nature. And even, you know, the first chapter of Genesis, you know, we had dominion over the fish and the animals. Subdue nature. It is there for you humans. You humans are the lords of the earth, and nature is a storehouse of resources for you. So in that, we are separating ourselves from the natural world by divine decree.
Yeah, it's so interesting how we do. Our society, our generation, we're very much told that we are just, I mean, it's the food chain, right? I mean, we were taught a food chain from the minute you learn science, I feel like. And so we're taught, here we are on the food chain, so therefore we are dominant and above. And I think that just fucks with your head right off the bat.
That fucks with your head. And it's not, it's the original peoples, the original, which is 99% of our ancestors, who were hunter-gatherers, pre-civilization peoples, they were, and this is not my opinion, this is anthropological study of these people. They were animists. They believed that everything was alive, everything was sentient, everything was agentive, everything had preferences, everything mattered, everything was of great spirit, everything was sacred, and that they were in a dynamic, interdependent, lived relationship with everything else. So sacredness was imminent on the earth. As if it existed, it was sacred and it was alive and it had a part to play. That's why you hear things in Native American speak, Brother Mountain, Sister Bear. It was because they were kin. And then civilization came and humans got clever with their philosophies, Plato and Aristotle in particular, and said that no, humans are the top of this food chain, and that nature is just a glob of biological automata that exists on its own for us. And that's how, and then the religious traditions followed suit with that philosophy. And that became our dominant way of thinking. That's why we're in the ecological crisis that we're in.
It's so funny. I was talking to someone on here. It might've been RJ Spina. I don't remember, who was saying, like, I think therefore I am makes his head explode. Because he's like, that just fucked us all up. He's just like, it's I am, so therefore I am. Right. Like,
that's right.
And how that philosophy started to just completely, like what you're saying, it became a major pivotal point of
mental overlays onto reality. You know, it was like when, you know, I live on Maui, that we just had this huge ecological disaster, this, you know, all of Lahaina burned. From soup to nuts, the entire thing. And the next day, about 20 miles from me, and the next day I start seeing the conspiracy theories, and it's a Chinese laser beam, and it's aliens, government, you know, and it was like, it's like, no, this is fucking air and fire, and to return something and to get aloha and the indigenous culture out from behind glass, which is where it was in Lahaina, because it barely exists anymore. And release it, you know, and that's its purpose. Mother knew.
Boy, I just got the chills.
The mother knew what she was doing, you know, and it has moved the needle on indigenous rights here because a lot of people were displaced, and the government is in the process of a big, like, fuck you to capitalism and saying, like, you know, all you rich people and you people from with corporate interests that hold all of this housing for vacationers at this huge price, we're gonna adjust what you can do with that housing, because we have all of these indigenous people who aren't being cared for, who don't have homes. And there's going to be legality, and it's going, you know, it's a bit of a shit show, and the corporate interest will fight back, but it is moving the needle. We, you know, when we think of indigenous knowledge, indigenous understanding of their ecology, it is knowledge. It is knowledge that the West, has never respected. They just come in and take over and say, no, it's this. And there's something to return to. These people know what they're talking about. And no native Hawaiians were saying government conspiracy theories. And, you know, that's just all the crazy people who are watching, you know, Fox News or CNN or, well, you know, all that stuff, you know, like the people infected with the culture, you know, which and part of the infection is about, we want you confused. We want you pointing the finger at the other. Because the more you do that, the more you will keep sending the money up to us. And the more that you blame each other for what we are doing to you, for the culture of enslavement that the architects of reality have put in place in the West. And the more that we fight with each other, the more we won't look at them. And make no mistake, they are sociopaths. They are sociopaths. They're not just narcissistic. They are, you know, infected. You know, the Native Americans talk about the virus of the mind that leads towards greed and solipsism and separation, and they call it the Wetiko virus. And it's a self cannibalizing virus of the mind that that when infected with, it kills its host, and its symptoms are greed. Its symptoms are the belief in separation. Its symptoms are profits over people. Its symptoms are disconnection from nature. You know, and those people at the top who put all this together, boy oh boy, they're not well. And
it's interesting, because when you talk about a lot of this and that disease, even though you didn't find your true self or your true identity or the true life until later, it seems, because you were even saying, like, I went into acting not for the fame but because of the artistry. The way you even talked about it right off the bat, about how you connected to a role and how you saw character, it seems like you were always a more grounded version of what that life could have been.
It's a mess. Yes, I mean, I had, you know, there was the fundamental building blocks of artist, channeler, storyteller, understander, empathizer. But I remember being in, you know, they have the bookstores in the airport, you know, and I remember being about 20 years old, and I don't know what became of this book, but I went to the self-help session, which is the only kind of book that I've ever read in my entire life. And there was a book, and the title was this yellow plain book, and the title was Feeling Good. And at 20 years old, I remember looking at that book, and I bought it and going, I wonder what that is. I can't even imagine that idea, feeling good like that. Like that was, it actually opened something, because I was wounded healer, you know, like I think so many of us are, you know. I think, there was a lot of trauma in my background. A lot of confusion. Still some privilege. And thank God I was taught that education was important. I'm on this path because I need to be. I'm a healer because I need healing.
Well, we all do. Where are you from originally?
Michigan originally, which is a good place to be from. but then Boston for college, New York for that part, and then I came here on vacation, I write about it in the book, just all these experiences, and at that time was very ensconced in the shamanic tradition, and I thought there's something here. There's something about Hawaii, and that really began a real dive into the indigenous philosophies here, and which are surprisingly psychological, which is where my wheelhouse anyway. That's where I live.
And what do you mean by that? Talk a little bit about that.
You know, I think like in shamanic practice, a lot of times it's experiences, and I go and I meet the power animal, and I get some healing, and that's all great. That's all great. Energy healing. I have a transcendent experience, or I get very relaxed, or whatever. But in working with shamans on three different continents, they tend to think and exist very similarly. They might have different practices, certainly different geographies, different traditions, but there's something about their outlook that felt very similar. And in the Hawaiian tradition, there's this philosophy, this shamanic philosophical outlook called huna, which are these, it's a lot of things, but these seven ideas that when you enter into them and live by them, they're not dogma, they're ideas. There are ways of looking at the world. And when you enter into a worldview where these ideas hold, you see through the mind of the indigenous. You actually see through their lens. You see through their worldview. So that was sort of like a real landing point for me, because I need to understand why. I can have those experiences, but I need to understand why it's working. When healing happens, I want to know what I did, what I did to make that, or what the client did to make that happen. I want to take that apart so I can repeat it. You know, I want to give it a philosophical basis to understand, because there really is some of what we consider magic and healing and all of that. It can be formulaic in a good way, in a way that says these are touchstones that we can follow that get us where we want to go.
Well, so that's what I was going to ask you. Do you feel like you have been able to answer those whys?
Yeah. The mystery is always the mystery. You know, it's more about that I can set up, and we all can, set up the conditions for the mystery to meet us, to bring healing or manifestation, you know, but it's about setting up the conditions. What is that worldview? There's a psychology to earth wisdom. There's a psychology to magic and manifestation.
Can you give an example?
Yeah. If you are trying to create anything on behalf of a self that is a false one, meaning one that is not ultimately connected to your original instructions, you know, and your original instructions also contained in those are your connection to the all. So when we are authentically ourselves, we are automatically set up, just like the dandelion. The dandelion is the dandelion. It only wants to be dandelion, but it is connected to, we're breathing dandelion right now. It's giving us, it's connected to the all by virtue of it being itself. It is part of the entire organism. So when we want to manifest something, if it's on behalf of that self, it'll come into being. If it's not, the spirits aren't going to reward us for a false self. Now you can override that process with greed and with, you know, the way other people do it. But if you are there's a teaching in Wicca that says if you work on behalf of self for self, you will find that self everywhere. And so it's not selfish. It's about when we are actually advocating on behalf of that that authentic reason, what Mother Earth intended us to be, we will create magic. We will manifest. We will bring things into being. And there's a whole psychology to get there, and a whole bunch of shit you got to get rid of to find out what that thing is, you know, that I'm manifesting on behalf of. So it's a real outlook thing. So that's one way. The first principle of Huna, you know it, Tal. It says that the translation from the Hawaiian is that the world is what you think it is. And I'm going to add both consciously and unconsciously, which means you got to know the other stuff that's running your show. Which means that what I'm believing about the world becomes the world.
Yeah.
Not just my experience of the world, but actually form itself.
That I always find fascinating.
Yeah.
Because I mean, it could really make your head explode if you really get into it. You're like, are we just also not only, like you said, subconsciously and creating our own paradigms mm-hmm. and our own, you know, futures and luck and presence and all that, yeah. but like, are we seeing, like literally seeing it differently than you wonder? As a kid, I used to wonder this. Like, I remember waking up one day and I was like, is my green someone else's green, or do we all just call that thing green, but maybe they're seeing it and it's my orange? Like, and it, I remember being really little, tripping myself out with that idea. And then I'm like, well, I'll never know. So who knows?
Well, the easy way to think of it, regardless,
but it's interesting. It's like
funny that you mentioned green, because if you think like green light means go, that is now a subconscious program in all of us. Green light means go. Mm-hmm. We don't have to bring that up consciously. We don't have to think about it. It's just on autopilot. It is lodged in our unconscious mind. And the outward reality mirrors back to us that green light means go, because it is lodged in our unconscious as a real thing that we can always rely on, that it's always there. I wasn't always a spiritual teacher, but now my unconscious mind is enmeshed with the belief that I am a spiritual teacher, and the outward world reflects back spiritual teacher.
Mm.
That's just a way to, you know, that's just a way to think of it. Now, I wasn't always a spiritual teacher. I had to go through that process. I had to go through that process of becoming that, not believing it for some time, dealing with my doubt and fear about it, doing all the studying that I needed to do. But at a certain point, I sort of went, okay, I got a room full of people here. I'm a spiritual teacher. And that got lodged in as a fundamental core belief that previously wasn't. My inward dream now says I'm a spiritual teacher, and my outward dream reflects it.
But it's not only creating a new core belief as much as, like you said, getting rid of the old core beliefs so that there's room for the new core belief.
Right. That's why you got to pay attention to what you're paying attention to. You have to really tend to what I do in my practice almost exclusively is I'm zhuzhing your worldview. Because if your worldview is not your fundamental, how you see yourself and how you see yourself in relationship to the world, if that is contrary to what it is that you want to create and who you fundamentally are, then you actually have to work to change that. You actually have to change beliefs. And the problem is that the misbeliefs have been around a long time. So you got to change them over and over again. You got to keep showing up for them. You know, so very simple exercise that in my book that, you know, I always have kind of first time clients do is write down all your negative beliefs. I'm ugly, I'm fat, I'm stupid, I'll never get, I'm not smart enough, you know, then rewrite them in their opposite and positive aspects, even if you can't believe it, even if you're faking it, because you got to get there if you're going to replace that one with that one, you know,
right.
So we have to actually look at, and that's why it's so important to look at our darkness, you know, to look at the stuff about ourselves that we don't like, because it's only by shining the light of awareness on it, not by avoiding it. Avoidance sucks. But by shining the light of awareness on it, that's what we can go, okay, I see that. That's never going to get me where I want to go if I keep financing and giving clout and legitimacy to that. So I have to change it. And then and I have to change it over time with discipline. And I used to not like that word, and I love that word now, because I think that this requires discipline. Yeah.
Why didn't you like the word? Just because in life you were like, don't tell me what to do.
Yeah, it didn't sound spiritual to me. It sounded a little bit like mechanistic or something, or not even, or not fun, or not graceful or something, you know. But
doesn't sound like magic.
It doesn't sound like magic. But but magic is a discipline of will.
Mm.
It's a discipline of will. And it says, like, I'm going to feed this potential and I'm going to starve this doubt. And I'm going to feed this potential and I'm going to fuck you this doubt. And I'm going to do that over and over and over again. And I'm going to feed the beliefs that finance this potential coming into being. And I'm going to starve the other one.
You know?
And I'm going to put up a boundary against it. And if it's too demonic of a presence, I'm going to try to kill it. I'm going to try to get this thing because we have this part of the psyche, the inner critic, you know, the superego, what Freud called it, that wants to maintain the status quo. It does not want us to grow. It wants us. It is connected to the culture. It is connected to stasis, to that which is conventional, to the binary, to the mundane, to the, you know, and when we are acting on behalf of ourselves away from it, it chatters, you know. And so our work is about, like, that inner critic is it, that voice, which originally was there to protect us and to tell us, develops in potty training. It tells us this is where we poopy and this is where we pee pee. That follows the culture, you know, like, and that becomes, but in this culture now, it is running the show of everyone, you know, because everyone is adhering to conventions of society, philosophy, really all of that, you know, and we got to get rid of that so we can become ourselves.
It feels like the superego, like, energetically, when it connects to, like, the greater greater communal consciousness, is also connected to, like, social media. It's like they all share.
Yeah. I mean, we have this idea that consciousness is coming through here, that's consciousness. That's
right.
You know, and no, that's just a narrative. That's just a narrative. It has nothing to do, you know, consciousness is actually that's, you know,
and for those who can't see this, he's pointing to his phone.
My phone. Yeah. In shamanic cosmology, if you think of the middle world, that's this world. That's this world. That's what is being peddled to us as reality. And it tends to be a mixed bag of a place, because Hawaii is there, you know, chocolate is there, boyfriends and girlfriends, there's good stuff there, but it's mixed bag. There's a lot of shit there, including the toxic culture. And that's the middle world. The lower world is our fundamental self, who are our connection with nature, the natural self. And the upper world is the spiritual realm. And the spiritual realm meets us when we are excavating and working on behalf of self. We don't have to reach up to the upper world. It comes to us when the spirits love it, when we are advocating and working on behalf of nature, because then we are one with the organism. So you got to get out of the middle world, you know, which tells us, and the middle world is designed to make it so that you won't ever go down there and you won't have access to up there. It's designed to do that so it can control you and keep you in a kind of obedience.
Right.
So when we talk about rewilding, you know, what we're talking about is that I'm unplugging from your, meaning middle world, rules, expectations, cultural conditioning, all, you know, politics, all of that, enough to where I can find who I actually am without the stench of you, all you. And then when I do that, the spirits come in and say, I am super on board with authenticity. I am super on board with nature. I have been taking care of I've been shining the light, the grace on this planet since its inception. And when the planet is doing it, and I keep doing that, you know, and that's when you think of the light, it's the sun. The sun has been shining on us, but it's spiritual light as well. And when it shines its light on us, we grow. And so when we're attempting to grow, the light comes.
What do you do? So everything we're talking about, and you're talking about now, and growing and evolving and, you know, really looking at, you know, how you think and your patterns, like you were saying, really pay attention to what you're paying attention to, I think were your words. Yeah. What do you do if maybe, like, someone who's done a lot of work, mm-hmm. but those patterns or those identities or negative speak that are so hidden? I don't know the right word for it, because meaning it's not necessarily the pattern that the person's, like, just not ready to deal with. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's so hidden. It's not even negatively affecting the day to day in an obvious way. It's like, what do you do? Is that when you go in with your energy medicine, like just deeper energetic patterns that are still keeping self from self?
I hear you. I think that, you know, there's something about things reveal themselves when they're supposed to, you know, and it might just be that it's not time for that thing to reveal itself. Generally speaking, though, I think the more that we are creatively engaged, that is what living a spiritual life is, that I'm creatively engaged with myself. I'm creatively engaged with what's happening. I'm creatively engaged with what's coming up on my screen of awareness and what I'm going to do about it. You know, I think the more that we do that, the more that hidden stuff is revealed. The one thing I have seen is that, you know, when you are in a therapeutic process or a spiritual path, and there's that thing that you go, I've looked at this from all sides, I understand it, I know what it is, but it's just not quite budging the way it needs to or whatever. Plants are helpful. The plants are helpful for that. That's when I say you need the plants now. You know, you understand this from all sides, but it's still tripping you up, you know, and, you know, I'm training in psilocybin. I don't do a lot of it. I don't do a lot of it at all. But psilocybin is a connector. That's what it does underneath the earth. It connects things, you know? And so when there's something there that's splintered off, you know, that can be very helpful, you know, but I think it's not super helpful unless you've done really all the work that you really come to now I need this, you know. So the plants can be helpful when it is something that's really stuck.
So talk about for you, like you were an actor, you were trying to do your thing. What even was your first spiritual, like, reaching out, and why?
Which story should I tell you? I remember I was, all of them. I'll tell you one. I was in Sedona. I was about 25. I was taking a Reiki class and privately.
But why?
You know.
But why were you taking a Reiki class?
Because I heard the word Reiki. I heard the word Reiki, and I couldn't get it out of my head, and I had no idea what it was, or you know, I just, you know, what it's that thing. It's that thing.
Yep.
I don't know. It feels right. Feels like something. Like I listen, you know. But I went to Sedona. In the closet, because Lord knows I'm not going to tell all.
I love how you hear the word Reiki. Next thing you know, you're taking a Reiki class in Sedona. It's like you didn't do it to someone's place in New York. It was like all of a sudden you're in Sedona.
I am. I'm that guy. I'm a little bit like a dog with a bone. I'm a Virgo. The God is in the details. So like, you know, like so anyway, I'm in Sedona and I remember I was on some trail and I was on this sort of mountainside and I had that moment, which many people speak a peak spiritual moment where there was a sense of, oh my God, I'm never alone and I understand things and I'm with it and it's with me and it knows that I know. And it's one of those, you know, one of those. Mm-hmm. And then I started walking, crying. And then I start walking down the hill and I start getting neurotic. Because I go, I'm not going to remember this. I'm going to go back to New York. I'm not going to remember that. I'm not going to be able to hold on to this. This is that level of attainment, that moment is like. So I got back to my hotel and I called a hypnotist in Sedona, and
you are Virgo.
And I said to the hypnotist, and she saw me that night, and I said, "Would you hypnotize? I've told you what just happened. It just happened this afternoon. Would you hypnotize that reality into my head so I don't forget it? Because I'm going to lose it. I'm going to forget it." And she's looking at me like I'm crazy, like you are now. And she had a yellow legal pad and she started drawing what looked like a picture. And then she said, "I can't do what you've asked me to do. That's not the way hypnosis works." And I said, "Okay." And she said, "You know, this session costs $150. I said, "Yeah, I'll pay you, you know." And she said, "Well, this is what I can offer you." And she turned it around and she had written in block letters the words, "Choose again." I said, "Choose again." She said, "Every time you forget what you learned on that mountain, you have to choose it again." And then we both like burst into laughter because it was like, that's it.
You know, $125.
$125. It's kind of like, yeah, I was on a podcast the other day and someone said, "What do you do with that altar back there? That altar behind you?" And I said, you know, not that much, except that every time I look at it, it reminds me of a reality that I'm choosing today.
It's like a 12-step program.
Sure.
Day by day. Okay. So then you're doing that and you're coming back and talk to me about what that meant for you. Because I mean, here we are, you're talking about your old self versus your new self. What are some of the realities you had to look at that you're like, this is not okay for me?
So I used to get cold sores and I wouldn't just get a cold sore. I would get New Jersey on my lip.
I'm from New Jersey.
Okay. All right. There. Yeah. I would really, like every month there would be this, you know, and I had heard in energy medicine that it had to do with anger. And I remember that there was something that happened in late in my career in show business that was bad and that was anger inducing that I knew was going to happen. And I thought, because I know it's not going to happen, it's going to be fine. And as soon as I got the official news that thing happened, there it was again, this outbreak, you know. And what throughout my life, what I have had to recognize is that when I'm angry, something's wrong. When I'm angry, something needs attention. That I'm supposed to feel my experience. I am not supposed to, that suffering is overrated. People pleasing sucks. And that I'm supposed to be in my experience and my body is telling me something about my original instructions, about my spiritual path, about my journey in this lifetime. My body is telling me something through how I am feeling through this experience, this experience. And I'm supposed to follow it. I'm supposed to listen, you know, and I'm supposed to honor that. And what's weird, this is really true. I actually don't get those anymore because I'm not angry about anything. I'm in alignment with myself, you know, like I don't really have that because the anger comes from boundaries being crossed and being in the wrong place and being used, being used. That's such a big thing for everyone. Don't allow yourself to be used. Don't prostitute yourself for someone else. You know,
go into that more because I think some people look at used as a very narrow definition, and I know what you're talking about. Like, talk about it in a broader perspective, because that's huge.
I mean, if you're spending your spirit and your soul for someone else's dream, which is called having a job, as we traditionally understand it, you know, and sometimes we have to do that. But it has a cost, and I'm being used to be for you. I'm being asked to leave myself to be for you what you need me to be. And for whatever reason, I decide I want to do that. People, you know, anyone who's listening to this podcast, anyone who's involved in anything spiritual, we tend to be empaths, which means that I am feeling into it. I've been good at it since I was a child. And anyone who's an empath has, I'm feeling into what you need me to be. And it is on autopilot for me to adjust. And if you're not an empath, you are attracting predatory energy that are perfectly happy to be the beneficiaries of you leaving yourself and jumping into them. And so there's this thing in Jung. Jung talked about the paradise of childhood. This idea that childhood, a fantasy version of childhood, is that we get all our needs met, and we're totally loved, and we get and we're totally taken care of, and we get the answers to everyone wipes our tears, and it's supposed to be this like paradise, a paradise that never comes. You know, no one ever gets that childhood, and there's a yearning in all of us to actually, even as adults, find that again, and powers that be, predatory energy, corporations, hierarchical systems say, I'll be your parent. You want a parent? I'll be your parent. I'll take care of you. And of course, what they don't tell you is that I'm going to use you.
Right.
You know, but it's that, and we're all susceptible to that, and particularly empaths. You know, so it's a really important thing to be aware of. Don't let yourself be used.
But it feels like we all let ourselves be used on so many levels that you don't even realize are happening, even within friendships, you know, relationships, within your family, whatever. It feels like even in relationships at times, no matter what version of that relationship it is,
yeah.
Like you said, if you're an empath, you kind of know what you need to be.
I'm a reciprocity Nazi. I'm a reciprocity Nazi. I am always, in anything I engage in, I am looking that the output is equal to the input. And when it isn't, I don't like it and I adjust it or I leave.
Were you always like that?
No. That comes from so much self-work. That comes with so much self-work. So much inner fortitude to not give a shit, you know, to have no fucks to give when it's out of reciprocity. Because, even in the Hawaiian tradition, aloha, which means love. It means love, but it actually means sharing energy. Alo means to share or face to face. And ha means breath. And oha means joy. So to share breath, to share joy. That's what love is. So it's a shared reciprocal experience. And the ethic in Hawaii, at least with the indigenous ethic, is that when aloha is given and it is not returned, there is no further obligation to give it. That is an actual ethic to follow, that love is about reciprocity.
That's interesting. Because sometimes you hear love's not about reciprocity. Love is about just
selflessness. And now we're back to the empaths who need to do work on themselves. Selflessness, martyrdom, you know, not mirrored in nature, by the way. Not mirrored in nature. Martyrdom is not mirrored in nature. Taking for oneself, being wildly interested in that which will bring me more life and wildly disinterested in that which won't, that's what's in nature. And when that's I do that, I'm connected to the all. Because I'm by virtue of my existence, I have a contributive factor to the all. And so the more that I am filled with life, and the more that I affirm what is good for me, the more that I grow beyond, I'm speaking as a plant right now, it's more that I grow beyond my current circumstances.
Which plant are you?
I don't know which one, or whatever, or microbe for that matter. But the more that I am growing beyond my current circumstances, that when I do that, I am actually contributing to the all. That I am just doing my part to my part, my individual cell of consciousness that is connected to the bigger organism of the ecosystem.
So when you started looking at the world through this reciprocity lens, how did it look different for you? Like, what was surprising?
I think adulthood, which I think most people who, even if they are an adult in age, haven't actually reached. I think it's a culture of adolescence.
But I think that's interesting.
I absolutely think that. But adulthood is a sense of, I know what I know. I feel what I feel. I know my boundaries. I know my truth. I know what I'll show up for and what I won't. I want to expand anyone who is interested in my medicine. I'm loving, you know, of all of those things. But I can't care what you think about me. You know, I often say to clients, sometimes they'll say to me, oh, Jonathan, you just blew my mind. It goes in one ear and out the other. Or they'll say, you're full of shit, in one ear and out the other. Because all I care about is telling you the truth. And if I care what you think of me, if I care that I'm pleasing you or that I'm feeding something, I just want to tell the truth. And I think adults tell the truth.
Right. You know. But it's tricky to be someone, an adult who's, because I tell the truth too. And I feel like if you tell the truth, not everyone wants to hear the truth.
No.
Like I had a friend say to me, and I've said it on here before, which ultimately I took as a compliment, but I remember, and she was like, oh, I go to you when I'm ready. Is what she said. She goes, until I'm ready to hear what's really happening, she's like, I won't go to you. If I need someone to just like coddle, she's like, I go to you when I'm ready to like do what I need to do. And I was like, oh, like, cause you know, you want to be there for it. But at the same time, I'm like, well, I guess that's good because she knows I'm not going to bullshit her and I'm always going to be honest, whatever that means. And of course help in any way I can. But it was funny. I'm like, yeah, some people just aren't ready.
If you can think of it more that it's not mean, it's mother. It's just mother. It's just, I'm just telling you what a good mother would. And sometimes what I have to tell you is hard to hear, but it's only because I care about you and because I've been around long enough. You know, I'm old now. And what that means is that like most of what you're going to present to me, I have been down that path. I have been burned. I know what it is. You know, I have the inner scars on the inside and the softness on the outside because of those experiences. And so I'm just trying to protect you. I'm just trying to take care of you. And so, and it comes from that perspective, you can get away with murder with what you say to people, because it's, because I'm never trying to disempower, ever.
Never. No. I agree. No, if anything, the whole point is, you know, it's giving power too. If, it's funny though, because what you were saying, when we were talking about mothering, and you said it's being a good mother, but you were even saying earlier, kind of this skewed notion of what we have, what we want, that, would you say the paradise childhood?
Yeah, right.
It's interesting because as a mom, you realize that it's, you battle, like I am the same way with my child too, very truthful in this, mm-hmm. but you battle this idea of a paradise childhood where you're not just doing the mushy gushy at all times. And it's tricky because and they want it.
I think part of it is preparing them for a big part of my practice too is really education around protection. It is not a cute world. It is not a cute world. Just look at how they vote. It is not, you know, there's a lot of mental illness out there, a lot of narcissism out there, a lot of baby minded men and women. You know, and so it's important to recognize that we will be in contact with them, and we have to take care of ourselves. It's not, I don't need to fight with you. I just need to know that you exist, so that when you're there, I can either run, bind you in some way, you know, but see you for what you are. And I think we have to be aware of that. You know, it's, you don't throw love and light at a narcissist. They are impervious to that energy. It does not work.
But don't you feel, in your practice, do you feel like, has the level of narcissism grown, or do we just talk about it more?
I think it's been unleashed as something that can now be legitimized. I think it's legitimized more in the culture. I think narcissism is legitimized. I don't know that it was, I imagine that it was always there to a certain extent. And even if you go back to the beginning of our conversation in mentioning Genesis, in saying humans top of the food chain, masters of the earth, that's pretty narcissistic. So it is very much in in the culture, you know, that, you know, me first and all of that, you know, and just to say this too, when I talk about self, I'm not talking about me first. I'm talking about true self, so that you are connected to the all, you know, that's that, you know, so it's not selfish, you know, but I think narcissism is legitimized now. I think it's a path. It's okay. There are open mouthed political systems that say, come with us if you're that. We understand you. And I think that was at least in the closet. You know, I think that was at least the source of shame that it should be. You know, but no, really, you know, it's something else. So I don't know if it's more. I mean, I do think, like, you know, they've added, I don't know, 100 new mental disorders to the DSM since its inception in the 50s, which means that all this consciousness work, all this esoteric wisdom that's available to us, all this psychology, you know, has led to, in the last 70 years, has led to more mental disorders than when it was originally written, you know, which is fascinating. So I think that we're not addressing something in ourselves.
I'd be curious to know your perspective, especially because you do so much of both of, you know, psychology and spiritual work. You know, there is a take, some like shamans, or there's a take that all mental illness are just forms of kind of unknown energy or unknown spiritual work, or people who are tapped in and not grounded enough. And therefore what we perceive as mental illness might be someone who's just kind of living in the veils or not quite mm-hmm. connecting all the pieces. What's your point of view on it?
I don't have one. I think for some people it is, if I were going to be shamanic about it, it is possessed, you know, it is possessed possessed with some sort of, you know, if you think of a demon is just something, a demon does not exist outside of the psyche. A demon is just something inside the psyche that blocks us from our liberation. That's what a demon is, you know? And so, and when, if that demon's really big and really strong in your space, you know, so there's that. But then I also think that there are, you know, there's a very famous article by Maladoma Somme, who's an African shaman, and he writes about visiting, and he's a real African shaman, and he writes about visiting a mental institution, and what Western medicine was calling a bunch of nuts, he was seeing people are in a process of spiritual unfolding. And from his shamanic perspective, that was happening. So, and you know, when you see that homeless woman who's talking to the birds, you know, she's in a consciousness. It's just not connected to, it's kind of like the seventh chakra is going off, but some of the other lower ones aren't functional, you know, but there is something there. She probably is communicating with the birds, you know?
I agree with that.
Yeah. But it's just not connected to being grounded, you know?
You're amazing. This has been a great conversation.
You too.
I'm very appreciative of it. Thank you. Thank you for sharing so much. I felt like you had a lot of really interesting insights and ways of talking about just things that we've talked about on this podcast before, but I felt you had a really interesting point of view or way to kind of look at it. And I even really appreciated the pay attention to what you're paying attention to. Because even though we talk about perspective a lot and creating your own reality, I felt like that was a very simple way of making it clear. And also, it's like a action item.
Yeah, that's great. Good. Yeah, everyone, go live your life. Go live your life. Go live your life and be on the side. There's two big energies right now, authoritarianism and freedom, and figure out what side you're on. I don't mean politically. I mean ideologically. And figure out what side you're on and go support that side.
Oh, that's beautiful. Well, thank you, Jonathan. I'd love to have you back on again. And I appreciate the time.
Aloha. Thank you for having me.
Aloha.